The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Alfie Bown is editor of Everyday Analysis, a blog and book series with Zero Books available at everydayanalysis.com, and he's an assistant professor in Hong Kong. He writes on critical theory and comedy, and his first standalone book with Zero Books is entitled Enjoying It, Candy Crush and Capitalism. It was published on December 11th this year, and the back of the jacket copy for the book describes it this way. Using a range of case studies from critical theory to Candy Crush, Gangnam Style to Game of Thrones, and Football Manager to Hieronymus Bosch, this book argues that we need to rethink our enjoyment. It's Wednesday, January 30th, 2015, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. I want to wish everyone a Happy New Year and let you know that there will be a special New Year's Day edition of Zero Squared coming on, well, New Year's Day. I should also let you know that simultaneously with his appearance today on Zero Squared, Alfie Bown is also a guest on the always enlightening Sea Realm podcast, where he holds up well under KMO's scrutiny. In this episode, you'll hear excerpts from a conversation with Harold Bloom, a reading of Yeats' poem The Second Coming. You'll hear clips of the music of Super Mario Brothers, an 8-bit version of Philip Glass's Koyaanisqatsi, some music from Schoenberg, and Syriac's Meow Mix. Right now you're listening to What Are You Doing New Year's Eve? From the Ukulele Teacher. But in just a moment, you'll be hearing Alfie Bown and I discuss his book, Enjoying It, Candy Crush and Capitalism. Alfie Bown is the editor of Everyday Analysis, a blog and book series with Zero Books, and the blog is everydayanalysis.com. He is an assistant professor in Hong Kong, and he writes on critical theory and comedy. He is also a Zero Books reader, and his first standalone book with Zero is called Enjoying It, Candy Crush and Capitalism. This is Alfie's second visit to the podcast. Alfie Bown, welcome to Zero Squared.
Hi, Doug. Thanks very much for having me. Cheers.
Your book, Enjoying It. In that book, you make the claim that enjoyment is the key to understanding ideology.
I came to the idea for the book kind of at random. You know, as I say in the book itself, I came to it. I was going to write an article for Everyday Analysis on the enjoyment of Football Manager. And I realized I was enjoying the writing an article about it as much as I enjoyed playing Football Manager, which is not a little, I assure you. It struck me that there was two different kinds of enjoyment happening on top of each other here. There was my completely committed dedication to my Football Manager career, in which I imagine that I've got a Scottish accent in my head, in my Football Manager persona. So I do the press conferences in my head and talked about all the players, you know, going in my head. I get really into it. I literally believe I am a Football Manager. I think it's because in the mould of Sir Alex Ferguson, I think that's probably why I've gone Scottish. And I really sort of enjoy it in a kind of raw, childish or seemingly raw childish obsession where I'm sort of, I have another identity in the game. And then I enjoy the level of kind of critiquing it and being sort of smart enough to use a bit of Foucault in a discussion of Football Manager and post this on my blog and watch people respond to that. And I suddenly realised that I had to scrap this article on Football Manager because I was getting involved in a much bigger topic of enjoyment and the different kinds of enjoyment that happen, and how there was a clear sort of divide happening here between these two forms of enjoyment, which seem to be completely opposed. You know, one of them a completely meaningless obsession with Football Manager, and the other, very refined critical theory readers' enjoyment and the enjoyment of studying popular culture. You know, so I wanted to think what kind of processes are happening here? And it's kind of one of my premises in the book that this is how we are controlled and organized as people. Is this class related? It's like a kind of second wave of what Victorian discourse called rational recreation. You know, this is a real government project which tried to organize potentially subversive people by channeling their behavior patterns into certain pursuits. And I sort of argue in this book that a similar thing is happening on a much more unconscious level, where we're being sort of organized and controlled, grouped and ungrouped via our enjoyments.
You seem to say two different and separate things right off the bat, which echoes the fact that you yourself were split as you attempted to critique Football Manager, right? You have this sort of puerile enjoyment, this unrefined enjoyment of Football Manager and taking the time to write about it just sort of as a fan of that. And then there's also the more refined enjoyment you take in being able to deploy this instrument of critical theory well and prove your logical chops, right? And and I noticed that in the 90s, when I first encountered sort of postmodern theory, that people who would write critically and philosophically about the popular culture of the time, and often enough it was Madonna, seemed to risk being seen as unserious because they might be seen to be enjoying Madonna more than they enjoyed taking her apart or deconstructing her or understanding the philosophy of it. And, you know, if you went and took these pop culture classes, you know, often enough, the reason you did that was because it was thought to be an easy A. I'll go and I'll watch a film and then we'll, quote, critique it afterwards. But
I think we're suffering from the opposite problem now. It's the case that, yeah, I mean, of course, I see what you mean. People do think that. People think my book, say, is less serious because it's got Candy Crush in the title than if it had the words austerity and in fact, I added the word capitalism because it made it seem like there was a serious dimension to it. So I think people still have that attitude, you know, slightly dismissive. Oh, if you enjoy Candy Crush, you can't possibly be interesting. But that's exactly what I'm trying to get at. I think what we've got here is a society which often unconsciously believes that if you enjoy certain things, you are radical and interesting. That is exactly the kind of organization of enjoyment I want to talk about. And if you enjoy Football Manager, it implies you're not the right sort of, you're not the sort of person who would enjoy Foucault. And I know many colleagues through my academic career who would have literally found it hysterical that I prefer hip hop to Wagner. And of course, I like both actually, I'm sort of fighting against not exactly what you described, that the idea that these things are not clever, but that there's too much of an association between what we enjoy and what type of radical we are. This is a really problematic enjoyment. I think that the people who only enjoy, whose identity is cultivated on the enjoyment of art house cinema, other things like that, that is perceived of as very different to someone whose identity is constructed through enjoyment of Football Manager. So enjoyment is this kind of key to identity, and I think there are value judgments unconsciously placed on different kinds of enjoyment, and that's what I wanted to kind of unpick in this book.
Okay, so how do you relate your critique of Candy Crush to an earlier critic's critique of, say, jazz? I'm thinking of Adorno here. Mm-hmm. I mean, Adorno would take the position that Candy Crush truly is a lesser art form and that the enjoyment of it is lesser than the enjoyment of, say, Schoenberg.
How would I relate to that? I'm certainly not taking a position which is critical of popular culture in the book, nor am I saying that popular culture, if that even is the right thing, that these popular phenomena such as candy fries, I'm not saying they're inherently radical, like modernist literature, or I'm not saying like Adorno might claim about other things that they're essentially radical or that they're essentially mindless. I'm saying they need very detailed attention because they can in fact be very important structures, and they can be very kinds of enjoyment which can potentially show us how we're kind of constructed as subjects through our enjoyment, through what we enjoy. And I think my main answer, which I perhaps should have mentioned before, is that what I'm getting at here is we need to write on what we enjoy, whether that is, I talk about the experience of medieval art, the experience of enjoying Deleuze, literary theory, enjoying art galleries, also enjoying Candy Crush, Football Manager, Gangnam Style. We need to write about what we enjoy, what one, the person writing enjoys, because that is where you can really unpick some of the structures of identity which are created by enjoyment and through enjoyment. And so I want to really move away from this very common, it's the absolute norm in the academy, at least, is to criticize things you don't enjoy. Criticizing the enjoyment of others is not something I do. I mean, everything in this book is an unpicking of my own enjoyments.
Right. Now, I think that's very different from what Adorno would do. Not that Adorno was wrong in his approach necessarily, but it does seem to me that he had this view that the kind of enjoyment you would get from listening to Glenn Miller was just different from the kind of enjoyment lesser than the kind of enjoyment you would get from modern music. And that, that in fact, in some ways, the enjoyment you get from popular culture, let's say from watching television, which was an enjoyment which was making you conform to the society that you ought to be trying to break free from, that enjoyment wasn't just lesser, that it just didn't even really count as enjoyment. It was alienated enjoyment.
That it was important for he and Horkheimer to alter that term, mass culture, to the culture industry is the new term they choose. It's because that term has certain resonances that he approves of, and we should maybe unpack those a little bit. The first is, of course, industrialization. Adorno is a sharp critic of Western industrial capitalism, industrialization, and because of its capacities, its ongoing capacity to sort of squash what he refers to in the opening pages of the essay, and sort of almost in passing, and throughout, he and Horkheimer refer to throughout Dialectic of Enlightenment as spontaneity. So you'll see what Adorno values in artistic and cultural production. You're meant to see, I think, in this essay, and remember that at its kind of etymological roots and at its beginnings, the essay is designed as a kind of spontaneous attempt, as a kind of improvisation on a theme or on an idea. So Adorno is trying to signal that his own essay is part of this ongoing unfolding of thinking. You're meant to see his thinking at work on the page. Notice that, too, on the opening pages, in the opening paragraph of the essay, he's very concerned with refusing the planning of culture and of cultural production by its industrial shepherds and owners and things like that. By those who have a kind of economic interest, a strong economic interest in refusing diversity and spontaneity in their publics, in their audiences, and instead trying to create markets for various kinds of products that are consistent, that are renewable, and that are fixed. If anything else, Adorno consistently opposes consistency. He opposes fixity of all kinds and works to find some of the cracks and contradictions that build themselves into systematic capitalism, and to prize those kind of openings into that large discursive body.
Our kind of contemporary moment is characterized by enjoyment, and that's of course not a new idea. It's an idea which Zizek has made much of, and many people since. But we seem to sort of admit, you know, that we are a hedonistic culture of enjoyment, and that enjoyment is the constant state of things, to quote Freud's Judge Schreber. And yet we don't interrogate those particular individual moments of enjoyment as we might. You know, we often think we understand them when we don't. And I'd say, despite his genius, you know, that's one thing Adorno might be guilty of here, sort of reducing, he even talks about the whole of popular culture in one swoop and the whole of false society, which enjoys it. So, within that, within all that, there are subtle. I mean, my discussion of Candy Crush. I think Candy Crush is radically different to Gangnam Style, and it's enjoyed for very different reasons in very different ways. And these would both be just categories of mindless popular culture for many people. It's about why enjoyment. Needs thinking about in different ways. What are the effects of enjoying different things on us? And I would say 50% of these effects are what you think of as, you know, entirely negative that I discuss in the book, and other moments of these enjoyments may be working towards something better, perhaps. I'm even reluctant to go down that route, but yes. But certainly the good, if there is such a thing, the good enjoyments and the bad enjoyments do not fall into the categories that they have done, that society has placed on them.
Let's take apart the notion of enjoyment a little bit, because you, in your book, present two different theories of enjoyment, at least two. There's Lacan's and there's Deleuze's. Would you break it down that way? How do they differ in their theory of what enjoyment was?
I think it's important to follow Lacan over Deleuze in this case, but I do want to say that what they stand for is more what I'm after here than what they actually said. So, in other words, there's no need for any Deleuzians to contact me and say I've got Deleuze wrong. I'm not so much interested in what they actually meant. Although, of course, I am. I read these two religiously, but it's more what has Deleuze come to stand for, and what has Lacan come to stand for, and that's why I think it gets interesting. You know, Deleuze has been picked up by is a very enjoyable critical theorist, you know, and very radical, of course, and all about the destruction of a capitalist society. And But this is probably something Deleuze never meant, but he's become the ideal critical theorist for people who enjoy critical theory. If you go on the Deleuze Facebook pages, you know, the ample evidence will be there. You know, it's people, many photos of people in romantic settings reading Deleuze, and many comments about the thrilling enjoyment of reading Deleuze. And that involves investing positively in a kind of enjoyment, which is related to Deleuze's ideas of desire. And, there is, I think, a danger of investing too positively in feelings of enjoyment, and in fact that is the main problem. We think that enjoyment is something we can't do anything about, and that we should follow our enjoyment. We live in a society which insists we enjoy, and we need to follow these enjoyments, and that's a good thing. This is not really something Deleuze said, but something that the consumption of Deleuze has really shows.
What's funny is Deleuze never said that, but he's thought to have said something like that, whereas Lacan said something that sounds very much like what you just said, that we should follow our enjoyment. He said, don't give ground on your desire. How is that different than follow your bliss or follow your enjoyment?
Well, that's a good question, and it's a very nice quotation from Lacan, isn't it? But I think it's don't give ground in relation to your desire, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Well, I think what Lacan's pointing to, broadly speaking, is the very close connection between identity and its enjoyments. Whereas Deleuze, if I was to misquote him, I'd say he was interested in an enjoyment which breaks out of the confines of modern capitalist identity. Now, Lacan is not interested in how enjoyment breaks us out of the existing structures. He's interested in how enjoyment is part of forming us as modern subjects. And that is the emphasis in my book. I'm not trying to create any kind of wonderful enjoyment which will break us out of capitalism. I'm interested in how is it that our capitalism organizes whatever we can call our modern social structure, with all the problems of talking about that in one phrase. But in what way does this social world in which we live control us and construct us as people through and by our enjoyments? So the book is about identifying those things and becoming aware of them rather than breaking out of them in a kind of Deleuzian way.
So what does it mean to give ground in relation or relative to one's desires as opposed to giving up a desire? Is there...
It's a hard quotation, isn't it?
It is. Saying, I just looked it up. It's something about one should not give ground relative to your desire.
Yeah. I think that's how I remember it. It wouldn't make sense to read it in terms of you should pursue every desire.
Right.
Because the thing wouldn't be desirable were it not for the barrier or prohibition asking you not to.
Right.
Pursue.
It's like he's almost saying, don't get too close to it either. Like, don't change your relationship to your desire. Like, don't move.
That is it. That's it. If you really got what you wanted, you couldn't handle it.
Right.
this barrier preventing you from access to pure enjoyment is a crucial one.
Right.
Whereas in Deleuze, you perhaps want to eradicate that barrier.
Saying it that way, I sort of relate to Deleuze there, because I've always thought that if your problem was that you had to, like, in order to be successful but on your own terms in your life, one of the problems that you'll have to face is actually getting what you want.
Mm.
You know, and that when you have the problem of getting what you want, it can be devastating, but strength is overcoming that devastation and finding something new to want.
No, but I think the Deleuze idea is in danger of having a kind of what's the word for it? It's not essentialism. It's a sort of naturalism. I can't quite find the word now. But if you say that I could still be me without these laws which are preventing me from getting what I want,
right?
You sort of believe in the possibility of existing outside or beyond those laws and regulations. In psychoanalysis, that would just not be possible. It's recognizing that those the laws have constructed you. So after you got what you enjoyed, you wouldn't exist.
Well, according to your book, when you describe Lacan and Deleuze, the difference is that for Lacan, the lack, the something missing, the absence is what comes first, and you only formulate a desire in reaction to it. And the way you formulate a desire is what fills in whatever you're missing. So, you know, just to put it in personal terms, as a young man, I decided I wanted to become a writer because that was going to overcome something I felt I was missing as a person. But it wasn't that the desire to be a writer became first. It was first my sense of lack, and then I came up with a story of what would be fulfilling of that. Deleuze puts it the opposite way, that there's some desire that comes first, and then the feeling that there's something missing comes after.
But actually, in this case, that is exactly a distinction which I've tried to sort of use the two and negotiate them well together. Because what I'm arguing in this book is that whilst Deleuze thinks there's desire outside of the modern subject. This would be another way to put what you've got, what you've said. Mm-hmm. Deleuze believes there's an experience of desire which is outside, or possibility of desire which is not a capitalist one. Lacan probably wouldn't agree with that. Yeah, I'm pushing the theorists into what I want them to say there, but that still works. But what I'm saying is, agreeing with both, if there's desire outside of capitalism, maybe, but certainly there is not enjoyment outside of capitalism, and they are different things, aren't they? Enjoyment and desire.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So for me, enjoyment is desire which has already been coded and constructed within a capitalist framework. And I don't think Deleuze would disagree with that either. I think both of them would agree with that. And if Deleuze could see some of these people enjoying his book, I think he'd be turning in his grave.
Enjoyment is the not quite grasping what you want. The enjoyment is having the desire that suits you.
Mm-hmm.
Is that
yes.
Right?
Yeah. Enjoyment always has a subject-preserving function. It may be radical too, but it's always got a self-preserving I think that's true. Enjoyment has always got a self-preserving quality in there somewhere,
right?
And I think enjoyments are when we enjoy things that we think are completely radical and completely outside norms, rules, regulations, or completely outside our political structure at the moment or whatever, when we're enjoying those things, we're never quite as free of those structures as we think we are.
Yeah, we can be sure that we're deluding ourselves.
Absolutely.
Right? If you're going, wow, I'm the most radical thing. I've broken free from every chain and I'm really enjoying my life as a radical motorcycle gang member or whatever.
Exactly. Well, and everyone listening is probably thinking, oh, that's true. And I'm not that. But just look on one of these Facebook groups. People unconsciously enjoy blindly believing that their enjoyment is, I think, quite radical sometimes. So basically, it's the opposite. So to go back around to where we started, it's a kind of attempt to hit back slightly against those people who were very dismissive of popular culture, because those dismissing popular culture unconsciously or deliberately implies other kinds of enjoyment are better. Now we've got a lot of these kinds of enjoyment which are celebrated as being good, especially as being radical. And I wanted to point out how these things are often coded and constructed by precisely the thing that these enjoyers think they're opposing. And of course, I'm one of them. I'm guilty of all this myself.
This notion of influence you're talking about now was not entirely new, right? Critics always knew that poets had read earlier poets. They'd mastered them.
But they assumed always that it was a benign process, that it only resulted in gain, not just gain and loss.
Where does the loss come in?
Well, the loss comes from the fact that you are haunted. The loss comes from the fear, the deep fear, that there's no room for you, that the time and space that you ought to occupy has been usurped or appropriated, that you have no ground upon which to stand, no word of your own to speak.
Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand. The second coming. Hardly are those words out when a vast image out of Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight. Somewhere in sands of the desert, a shape with lion body and the head of a man, a gaze blank and pitiless as the sun, is moving its slow thighs, while all about it reel shadows of the indignant desert birds. The darkness drops again.
Now let's talk about the canon, because you talk about this question of the canon, and it's not unrelated to what we've been talking about so far, because I think maybe what you would say about the canon the literary canon say is, especially the modern, a modernist canon, would be that the, what we're finding in the canon are works that you are to enjoy precisely to the extent that they're subversive or progressive or breaking free of the norms that came before them. That these are the canonical books are books that do not partake in the worst, most debased, most consumerist, say, or simple-minded aspects of the culture, but are trying to develop the culture to whatever the next step is. Sometimes, like, you know, people are grouped together that have very little in common, like Joyce and Beckett, except in so much as they're both considered to be departures from literary tradition and adequate ones, ones that are truly radical and that can be enjoyed radically. And you would question all of that, right?
Yeah. I think I would. And, and that's where you can get into. So in the in a literary context, you know, just to kind of keep it in a literary context, yeah, I would absolutely oppose the idea that they can be enjoyed radically. And I think that, you know, as a kind of, even in a kind of reader response way, you know, what we need to do is, I'm not telling people to not enjoy these books, but what we need to do is enjoy everything we enjoy, but be very critical of that, of the enjoyment itself, you know. So I don't mean be critical of Beckett, but be critical of how is it which I'm enjoying this text. The text has certain cultural capital, certain cultural status. The act of reading the text, whether anyone knows you're doing it or not, says certain things about you, comes with certain kind of cultural values attached. And what needs to be analysed is the actual moment of enjoyment. Right. Between which occurs between the text and the reader in that scenario. I'm not saying that people pretend to enjoy them to look clever. It's the opposite. I mean, we actually do enjoy them, and it's a case of analysing those moments, the actual enjoyment, and how that functions as a kind of in between space between the thing and the subject and the object. It connects by enjoyment, and this is something we can really think about, this relationship, and I don't think it can be, there's not one answer to that, you know, each relationship between object and subject, reader and text, player of Candy Crush and Candy Crush itself, there's a interesting enjoyment linking that and constructing both these things in relation to each other, and that's what we need to get to the heart of discussing.
You know, okay, I tend to think about like literature and the avant-garde and radical politics as having some things in common. One of the main ones being that the radical politics wants to create a new structure for society. That's what someone involved in radical politics wants. That's what makes it radical, is that you're trying to set up a whole new framework, a whole new point of conception for society. And in the arts, the same thing has been true, and much more concretely and realistically for radical artists, that they've tried to set up new criteria for new forms of art. So it seems to me that in the arts, the moment of arrival for these new forms is always one of dissonance and dissatisfaction, that almost invariably, that, you know, you're misunderstood. Manet, for instance, was a painter who people thought couldn't paint until he was later on, people found out ways to enjoy him, but not at first. So that maybe one of the markers of a new structure being built is that it seems dissonant, in disarray, and somewhat unenjoyable. Do you think that's also will be true of radical change politically?
The moment that something new kind of arrives can seem unfulfilling and disappointing, because it compared to the promised fulfillment of the destruction of the old, the actual visualization of the new can often be depressingly incomparable with the idea of getting rid of the old and how great that could be. On the other hand, what you're asking about the kind of history of how things are consumed, I really don't think we're in the that society anymore. I think this is kind of, you know, to use a kind of, but to borrow a kind of metaphor that is going around in these leftist circles, you know, it's end times when it comes to that, or it's end game when it comes to that kind of thing. Like, no, there's no way that, I mean, of course, we still produce brilliant art and things like that. But I think there's a kind of enjoyment crisis going on at the moment. You know, this not going to fit into a discussion of how people responded to these things. Is it a question about radicalism, what you're asking us?
No, somewhat. I mean, let me see if I can rephrase it a little bit. Because what I was saying before was, I was just asking you if you felt that truly radical moves, whether they were done in the realm of art or in the realm of politics, would be moments where it was impossible to find easy enjoyment, or whether or not you thought it was possible to enjoy something that was truly radical. Up to this point, I would say that you've been arguing that that our enjoyment always sort of is a good indicator that that we haven't made any radical break truly. But you can see that in the traditions of modernism, modernist painters, for instance, were perceived to be incompetent, and people did not enjoy their work until later, until after a new way of understanding and a new way of enjoying their work arrived, in which case their work was no longer radical. It was the mainstream, or it was taken up.
Well, I suppose that shows partly what we're kind of getting at with the need for a sort of social structure to unconsciously or consciously organize enjoyment. And yeah, that, you know, if something radical appears, then so I think actually I understand your question now. If something radical appears, then the society shifts. Often, or there's a reaction against that, reorganizes enjoyment. And produces a new structure in which that thing can be safely enjoyed. And I think something like Deleuze is a very good example of that. Some very radical ideas, very radical, the volume of radical text produced by someone like that, which were very unsettling to its own moments, you know, at the time. Deleuze was completely unsettling. Now, many people think theory had its day. You know, obviously, I think that's wrong. But nonetheless, there's a new kind of way of enjoying Deleuze, which is not as something unsettling to subjectivity, to the political status quo. Of course, the enjoyment of the thing. The same object is obviously completely different. The enjoyment of the object is different in different times, and I think that's true. When these things become more clear cut, enjoyable, they're less radical. Whereas the most radical enjoyments, as I try and pick out in this book, are ones which are not necessarily you'd feel comfortable saying I enjoyed that. It's moments of enjoyment where you feel very disconcerted. And I think some of the art you discussed there and some of the critical theory we've discussed had that impact. And then culture functioned to iron out and smooth over those unsettling feelings that those texts, art, political movements produced, and ensure that they were then enjoyed safely. I think that's good. I think that's a good point.
Yeah, well, but the thing about being a radical is, I mean, okay, when it comes to painting, when it comes to the shift, say, from the academic schools of painting to Impressionism, for instance, that break happened, and what came out the other side was not a return to what had come before. I think that in many ways, artists did escape the traditions that had been imposed on them before. When it comes to radical politics, we haven't had that kind of success. We haven't created new forms of economies and new forms of social societies that truly were a break from capitalist forms.
No, that's true.
So when we're talking about it in the realm of radical politics, it's always been a return to what had come before and sort of a neutralization of the radical break rather than a transcendence of what, you know, through radical break. Because I think either way, when you get to the other side, you're going to find a new way to enjoy the new society, and you'll feel rather safe within that. Hopefully,
yeah.
You know, we don't want to, we're not actually aiming at total disorder. We're aiming at a new order, not to use George Bush's phrase, but so anyway.
Okay. I think enjoyment is as entrenched as capitalism in these terms. Then, you know, just as you say that, you know, capitalism always seems to be the norm. It's a kind of it's just as it's impossible to think of what an alternative to capitalism would look like. It is firmly kind of entrenched, so that we can't even imagine alternatives. I think there's something going on here that the which is related to enjoyment. The way in which we enjoy is very firmly entrenched, and I don't want to sort of pick out. Obviously, it's impossible to say how and when this happened, but the idea of a particular this is one of these sites. I think enjoyment is a site at which something which society is completely foreclosed upon and accepted as a kind of natural or inevitable way of things is one of a site like that. One of these sites is enjoyment, and it can potentially break up long-standing unconscious assumptions about how we are. Like, for example, the idea that enjoyment we should feel an impulse to enjoy the things we enjoy. It's a little bit of a stretch to say that enjoyment is thought of as natural, although I don't think it's too much of a stretch. I mean, one thing I tried to prove is that the way we talk about enjoyment and in our society is that we trust in our own enjoyment, and we almost see it as a kind of natural thing. You know, I couldn't choose what I enjoy. I just am drawn to it. You know, we may, on the other hand, say, no, it's not natural. It's because we were socialized in a particular way. But nonetheless, it's the way we see it in our imaginations. And a great Louis Theroux documentary from about 5 years ago, it was about it's called Behind Bars. He goes to various prisons and discusses with inmates, you know, why they committed their crimes. Almost every single one of them blamed their enjoyment of things society considers transgressive for their crime. So I enjoy things which society deems are illegal, and therefore I ended up in prison. So this shows, I think that's a good example to show how enjoyment is something we think we couldn't help it. We couldn't help what we enjoyed, right? This is part, and that's an extreme example I've given where people are enjoying illegal things and can't help doing so. But it applies to a lot of things. You know, how do we talk about Candy Crush, for instance, or Football Manager? Oh, it's just, I wish I didn't enjoy it. You know, I wish I was doing something more useful, but I do, and so I don't give ground in relation to my desire, and I do those things now. That is based on a number of assumptions about enjoyment, in my opinion, that enjoyment is a gift of nature, is something we cannot help, is something that chooses us, which I agree with in some ways. But these are not natural things. This is an ideology of enjoyment.
Earlier you said that we're in a crisis of enjoyment. And would you characterize that crisis as being a moment where it's impossible not to find at least something to enjoy? Or that you can never be shaken out of your current predilections towards enjoyment. Like if you created a painting like Manet did today, not the same painting, but one that broke the traditions of now, the way he broke the traditions of then, that people would not only reject it, but just be unshaken about their commitments.
I believe that's the case. Yeah, yeah. I think you probably put it better than I could there. I think that's it. You know, I try to recover in this book some unsettling moments of enjoyment, and these were tiny and hard to find. I think they possibly exist, but in general, I think that's exactly what I mean by a kind of crisis of enjoyment now. It's become very difficult to enjoy something in any other than a safe and preserving way. You know, it's I think enjoyment. Yeah, sorry.
No, this will be a good time then maybe to just talk directly about Candy Crush. But hold on one second, because my cat's just been meowing to be let in for about 10 minutes, and I'm going to go let the cat in so that I can enjoy our conversation more. Hold on one second. All right, so now my cat's in here, and she'll start making noise by knocking things off my desk. Let's talk about Candy Crush and the culture of distraction, which are...
Yeah, okay.
How does the culture of distraction fit in to your idea, with your idea that it's impossible not to preserve the self through commitment to our enjoyment today?
So this idea of a culture of distraction, I'm taking from the German-Jewish writer Walter Benjamin, who felt in the 1930s that we were in a culture of distraction. Where distraction played a kind of crucial role in our culture, and the traditional reading is, of course, that we're so distracted all the time we can't do anything worthwhile. Now Benjamin didn't mean that at all, and he was saying that our culture is defined by distraction, so that distraction creates the kind of sense of what's important and what's valuable. And this is a really point that Benjamin made that seems to have disappeared from readings of popular readings of Benjamin anyway, that as soon as you talk about culture of distraction, people are going, oh yeah, we do live in a culture of distraction, don't we? I'm always distracted and it's terrible. That's not really what Benjamin meant, I think. And what's really more radical about what he was saying is that the culture of distraction, what role does distraction play in our culture? It allows us to unconsciously affirm that there is something which is not distraction, which is productive modern capitalist work. And that's one of my main arguments in this book, that the culture of distraction, which Candy Crush obviously epitomizes, is a way of making sure that everyone unconsciously feels guilty and that they shouldn't always be distracted and they should do what is productive and undistracted, what is useful, what is worthwhile. And those things are not useful and worthwhile, but they're made to appear so by being different to all the annoying moments of distraction that characterize our daily life.
Benjamin's ideas about distraction, did he write about those in his most famous essay, The Age of Mechanical Reproduction, or the Aura of...
There's an essay in the book One Way Streets, which, of course, the work of art in The Age of Mechanical Reproduction is on a similar topic. Right. There's an essay on distraction in One Way Street, and there's also some very interesting fragments in the Arcades Project about the experience of going through the Parisian arcades as a kind of culture of distraction.
He thought, what I remember, and this has been a while since I've read that essay, and it's been a while since I've engaged with Benjamin, but my memory, if memory serves me correctly here, so he felt that the movie, the cinema, was particularly radical in the ways that it broke continuity and didn't allow the audience to become totally mesmerized by the scenes, that there was a distraction built in to cinema. And Adorno and he really disagreed about this, about the way films worked. Could you spell that out for me and refresh me about whether or not Benjamin felt that that this culture of distraction itself was a way to break with capitalism, or whether he felt that it was something that was confirming capitalism. Or am I mixing up his ideas about cinema and what his
I think maybe a little, because it's right that Adorno was super critical of that in the culture industry, exactly the same things which Benjamin thought had a more potentially radical side to them. I think Benjamin was always more attentive, this will annoy people probably, but I think Benjamin was always more attentive to ambiguity of these things. And Benjamin and Adorno are both popular culture writers, and they share much. Obviously, they were great friends and that. But one thing is that Adorno always seems so concretely sure of one thing being worthless and another thing being useful. And I think Benjamin's writing really picks up on the ambiguity of these things. And distraction is a disastrous alternative to contemplation, which Benjamin thought was a useful reflection on things. On the other hand, and as you rightly say, it stops the viewer from thinking. Whereas, as you're saying about cinema, he felt there was a sort of unsettling moment. There was an unsettling quality,
mm-hmm.
Which forced people to think. And I think they're not unrelated, because that's the sort of ambiguity you find in Benjamin's treatment of the popular, actually. And the Arcades Project is a wonderful example of it. How everything is completely ideologically problematic, but also contains within it potentially groundbreaking moments. And I think that's what I'm trying to say about enjoyment too. That all of these enjoyments have a radical kind of potential to undo something or make something apparent that is hidden. Because enjoyment is a key way in which we're controlled, it's also a moment at which that can come unhinged. And that's more Benjaminian than Adornoan, I think.
I had this experience of going to watch Trek in the Park here in Portland, where instead of doing Shakespeare in the Park, they reenacted an episode of Star Trek very well, too. Full costumes, set design, all of that, all in the park. And what I realized was, as enjoyable as it was, that the aspects of Star Trek that I truly enjoyed, that set up my desire for Star Trek, were sort of absent from this reenactment. That instead of being brought into a world where I was made to question what the capacity of people might be in the future, or consider a more utopian vision of society, I was instead sort of reassured by being rewarded for my knowledge of this, you know, 60s television program. And so we were, it was more of a, you know, a call and repeat situation, at almost a religious quality of people. Would you know, joy would go through the crowd as they recognized characters walking on, you know, oh, that's McCoy. Oh, they did a good job on McCoy, or, you know, whatever it would be. And I thought, that's when I decided I wanted to write about how we should watch Star Trek. And I think it relates to Lacan, is when you start to enjoy Star Trek in itself and be, you know, just as a fan, you stop pursuing your true desire, which is what set up your relationship to the series to begin with, which has to do with this vision of a new kind of life in outer space, say. Do you think that there are ways to enjoy even something like Candy Crush that might not be giving as much ground to your desire as we tend to do in our daily enjoyments?
Yeah, okay, good question. So it's about whether there are different ways of enjoying... Yeah, absolutely. There are different ways of enjoying the same thing. Like I sort of said before, don't want to get into saying whether one thing is radical or whether one thing is not. It's not about the things. Okay, this is, I think, quite important. It's not about the objects in question, like I tried to say before. It's about the relationship, the enjoyment which connects you to the object. And I've been really pleased in the very early stage. Obviously, the book is out yesterday, 2 days ago. I've been really pleased. I've seen a few reviews, and each of them has wanted to put this these questions in their own terms, right? So one in the New Cross Review of Books confessed his enjoyments in the game Karoshi, which is a mobile phone game where you sort of, I think you just sort of beat people up who aren't conforming to social laws. But it's like, you know, you repeatedly tap it and they get bloodier and bloodier, things like that. And someone else has put it in terms of his enjoyment of particular popular culture aspects, and other people have thought about it in terms of their enjoyment of literature. And that's what I want to say here, that I think this is what I want the book to do, and if it can succeed in doing that even a little bit, then I'll be pleased. That it's a framework for talking about enjoyment, and it's not saying some things are worthwhile and some things aren't. It's saying we've all got these kind of moments of enjoyment which link us to all sorts of things. And those enjoyments are the things we need to analyse. So if people are turning it back into reading their own enjoyments, then that is exactly what I hope happens here. And obviously, even by thinking about Star Trek in those ways, you seem to be doing that. And people have said that, oh, I read this, and then I thought, you know, shit, is that how I'm relating to X in my, enjoyment structure? And now almost always, that's just the beginning of the discussion, and it turns out the way that this reviewer enjoys Karoshi is quite different to the way in which I enjoy Candy Crush. So there can't be sort of, it's not like apply this theory and you'll understand it, how you relate to these things. It's more a case of each of these moments is different. Each of these moments of enjoyment is different, and each of them can show us important things about how we relate to objects and how we relate sort of through our enjoyment to them. It seems like people are thinking immediately about how their own enjoyments would fit in these discussions, and I think that's what exactly I hope it will do.
That's great. Is there anything I didn't ask you about here that you wished I did?
One thing I wanted to pick up on, based on some things on the Zero site, is people's kind of this particular kind of enjoyment found in criticizing other people's attempts to be radical on Facebook.
Yeah.
And I'm going to write something on this because it's in the fringes of the book, but not quite in there. And it was something I've seen. You know, people, I'll post something like this. We did this video about whether Hunger Games is radical, you know, and people will post like a meme which proves me wrong. You know, and I think there's something very funny about this the meme itself, you know, I was tempted to write on, it's claimed that, you know, we love the radical characters in Hunger Games, but then we just conform to society afterwards. So we're kind of, ironically, we're just doing something stupid because we love to say, oh, look how radical Katniss Everdeen in Hunger Games is, and then we go and be the least radical people ever. When actually, I think what's important is Hunger Games radical, not are the characters in it radical. But my point was more that this is a kind of enjoyment which is going on at the moment, which I would particularly like to get rid of. It is this kind of left wing people who are all part of the same general project, really enjoying having a dig at each other on social media.
Yeah, what is that about? Let's talk a minute or two about that, because it's. I've noticed, and I actually think that the Zero Books Facebook page is some of the more muted.
Yeah, we're doing quite well on there. People actually talk about things nicely to each other.
For the most part. Well, you don't get as many comments, and maybe it's because we're not getting as much of that. But also, when you do get comments, they're a little bit more passive-aggressive. I've noticed it in some other places. But, this is the defining characteristic of what I call the Facebook left, is the love of digging in on someone.
Yeah, I think we should do some serious work on the Facebook left at some point. That's a good phrase.
The problem is, but once you start to critique the Facebook left for being like this,
you're doing it. Yeah. Well, I think there's a very different kind of enjoyment going on. When you enjoying talking about politics is one thing, isn't it? And that's good. you know, and we all get to feel like we're being very interesting, and that's fine, and that's good. But enjoying the little dig. Now, I think I have got an explanation for that, and it's that, you know, if you give a, we look, what we do is we look at each other's attempts, and you give your little dig, and it confirms to you that your way of doing it, because you've got a little niggly criticism that you can make, you know, it confirms to you that your way of doing it is comparatively good. And of course, you know, that's, I think, what's happening, and what one thing we ought to try and work against as the left, as such thing exists, is, of course, we want to argue over the important things amongst ourselves. I'm not saying just like be nice and get along, but your target is it's a wrong target there, isn't it? Is that with some of this kind of it's what Nietzsche would call ressentiment. You know, radical energies are directed against each other rather than against the structures of power which are causing all this. So it's really a sort of conformative kind of enjoyment that you get from your little comment or posted meme. I noticed the meme was taken down, preventing me from further. I wrote there, this meme is completely reactionary, and the meme disappeared.
Oh,
I can't remember even who posted it, but I wanted it because I wanted to actually, you know, write on the meme or something. But then, as you say, you'd be doing the same thing. I think, yeah, if we can have a. That's different. It's right to argue about the important issues, even whether they're abstract theoretical questions like Lacan or Deleuze, or whether they're questions about what we want to do politically with this discussion, say, of enjoyment. Those are all important things to talk about, and I never mind being criticised, but there's definitely a different kind of enjoyment, which is a much less radical one, coming from this.